Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Check out tens of thousands of technical articles on our new knowledge hub on farmersjournal.ie.
Now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, farm debts in distress, how insolvency agreements offer a lifeline. Hannah Quinn Mulligan and Granny Catherine welcome newborn goslings to the farm. And later, the CEO of Greencore, Patrick Coveney, joins me live in studio.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
Yay, it's the 30th of January, only one more day to go on what is possibly the longest January on record. And the weather here in Dublin this morning, it caps it all off, I can tell you. Now, it's been a difficult month, which makes the signs of spring to come more precious. The stretch in the evenings, the brighter mornings, the fresh shoots of spring flowers peeping through. And down on the farm in County Limerick, Catherine Quinn and granddaughter Hannah have had some unseasonably early new arrivals.
Look at that.
Oh, look, its little head is peeping out over her wing. Oh, look. Oh, that's so sweet.
We'll have more on that later. But first, I'm driving down the country and it's raining. And Joe is taking calls from listeners who've had bad experiences with financial institutions.
Well, I'm not going to match Joe, but she borrowed 80 and there's 200 grand owed, so that's 100.
Well, I'm on my way to meet a farming husband and wife who have their own story to tell me of the stress they endured when they fell into arrears on a bank loan, which was subsequently sold on to a so-called vulture fund.
The roundabout, take the third exit.
But first I call Pat McCormick, the president of the ICMSA, to find out if there are many farmers who have had their loans sold to vulture funds.
Hi, Damien. How are you?
Hello, Pat. How's it going?
Look, there are, I suppose. Yeah, no, well, you may never know about the people that have loans sold to vulture funds. It's those that fall in arrears that you'll certainly hear about. And in fairness, COVID-19, there was a time frame there from March to early November where they left people and farm families without disturbing them. Obviously, that lifted the first week in November, and at the same time, we had 12, maybe 15 farmers with serious issues, and it varied, you know, from people contacting the office saying that their neighbours rang them to say that their farm and their home were up for sale on the internet, and they weren't aware of it, and that's unacceptable. So there are a significant number of farmers, and look, Damien, I'm sure your listeners will say that people borrowed money and that they have to deal with the consequences of that. Usually when you look into these farm families and their issues, there is some underlying issue that was totally unexpected that has prevented them from being able to make their financial commitments. And whether that's animal health, outside TB, BVD, yones, any of those things. And inside it could be a spouse, or indeed it could be themselves with some underlying health issue. Albeit, I suppose, we've also seen that the challenges of, in particular, 2018, where we had an extremely late wet spring, which cost the wetter farms significantly as regards production, you know, right through from the middle of 17, right through to mid 18. And equally, we had some of the dry farmers. So there's a variety of reasons, I suppose, why farm families find themselves in arrears.
That's great.
John Damien.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Pat, thanks a million. Cheerio. Thanks a lot. Bye. Bye. I continue my journey to meet the farmers whose name and location they do not want to reveal. But they do want to share their story if it means helping other farmers in a similar position.
When you become vulnerable and when you need money or when you get into debt.
We're dairy farmers, and my husband inherited this farm from his dad. So I'm here now. I'm here over 30 years, so we're here a long time now.
And it's always been a dairy farm, has it?
Always been a dairy farm. We took out a bank loan in 2000. We got lots of advice on getting the loan, and everything was fine with that end of things. We were going well. We were going okay with the loan, and we sold sites to reduce the debt, the overall debt. And in 2013, we did our TB test. In this test, 32 cows out of the herd of 76 went down with TB. This was a big ordeal for us because at this stage we knew we were in trouble. And adding to this, the same week my husband was diagnosed with a brain tumour. So we knew we were in trouble, but the brain tumour, it only needed ongoing monitoring. There was no operation required on this.
Okay.
So that end of things worked out better than, but still it was a setback. Our whole cow herd was depopulated.
And did you get compensation for that?
We did. We got compensation. We got TB compensation for that. We went to the bank and the bank looked for their money. They looked for to see could we give them the TB compensation or could we give part of the TB compensation. But we just couldn't because if we did, we weren't going to be able to get back in and it just wasn't possible for us to give them the money at that time. So in return, they sent us on to recoveries. We paid to recoveries as much money as we could afford.
So you needed the compensation, though, to restock the farm, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And when you explained this to the bank, their reaction was what?
Their reaction was they wanted their money, they wanted their loans, and if we couldn't pay it, and then the following year we couldn't pay it either because we were only getting back and we were trying to restock.
What happened there was we got locked up at TV the following year again after getting back in with two animals. And so we approached the bank looking for interest only for 2 years and they declined our application.
Going down with TB, did that not resonate with them at all?
No.
No, it didn't matter, as the lad says, what we done. They didn't listen.
So in 2016, they sold on our loan to a vulture fund. They wanted their money back as soon as possible. They weren't going to give any long-term agreement at all. We would have been just happy with paying back the amount of money over a given time. We knew if we were given the time that we would have been able to manage it. So in May 17, we had a meeting in Dublin with a vulture fund. And this meeting, I'll always remember, there was big doors. This meeting was just so cold. They were sitting in suits behind. Our financial advisor at the time was with us. And he was amazed at how cold they were. And they just needed their money back straight away. And that was it. My husband's health was deteriorating both mentally and physically at this stage. And the stress on us as a family was actually unbearable. For example, there was one weekend, our daughter said to her dad, we're going to have a lovely weekend this weekend, Dad, because the banks are closed on Monday. I think it was closed, they were closed on the Friday and the Monday. She was 10, I suppose.
10
or 12. She was all psyched up about having a good weekend with her dad. So there was no phone calls and there was no letters through the door. We got our doctor to write to the financial and the financial advisor, asked them to go easier and that we would get it sorted. And we were going to get it sorted. Everything would go if we were given the amount of time. But the Vulture Fund sent back our advisor the number for the Samaritans. That was their answer to go easier.
They agreed to sell an out farm and a site on the home farm to raise the funds needed to pay off the debt. But the financial institution didn't agree to this and put the home farm up for sale online for a quarter of its value. It's only when their own auctioneer, who was selling the site on their behalf, rang them to tell them how perplexed he was that they were selling the entire home farm that they actually knew it had been put on sale online.
But we knew nothing about this. It was up for sale for $150,000. The Vulture Fund told us that they had an offer of the $150,000 with cleared funds, so they were going to sell the home place.
In the meantime, the couple had found a buyer for their out farm. However, the Vulture Fund said that they wanted to conduct the sale directly.
No matter what undertakings we gave that to get the full proceeds of the sale of land, it wasn't happening. They wouldn't allow it.
They demanded the contact details of the potential buyer, and only then would they agree to take down the online ad for the home farm.
We thought that the home farm didn't was safe.
Okay.
That was the whole priority, was the home farm had to be saved. But in 90 days from the day they received the money, of the out farm, put the home farm back up again.
Oh.
But they also, well, for 300,000 that time, and they only owed 60,000. They also had a security of another out farm that we have of 30 acres. And they could have used it to get their 60,000, but they came for the home farm.
With the family farm back in the market against their wishes, a lifeline. They heard that the ICMSA was holding an information meeting about personal insolvency arrangements for farm loans that had been bought by so-called vulture funds. They were too distressed to go along, but a friend went on their behalf. The following day, he gave them details and they were put in touch with a personal insolvency practitioner. It's the moment, they say, that literally changed their lives.
You know, it was just brilliant. They rang us up, they got all the details, and he had a team, and the team worked through anything they'd ask us, and they were just brilliant.
What sort of an arrangement are you in now? I mean, I presume the loan just didn't disappear
completely. No, the loan just didn't disappear, but it's over. We have the schedule now that we always require. We have a length of time. And that's all we ever wanted.
There's no doubt there's people listening saying, you know, you borrowed, you gambled, you got messed up, it's your problem.
Well, things can go wrong for anyone, at any time, in every walk of life. And things just went wrong on us. TB, my own health, things went wrong on us. And when you're signed to the hotline, you don't take it in things. And we just thought we'd get a chance to restructure and get back. We didn't get that chance. So we can move on from here.
We borrowed the money, we knew we had to pay it, and that was what we wanted to do.
How is your mental health now?
Not bad, yeah. That's just, when you don't have the letters coming in the post, the phone calls coming, and then go to bed at night and wake up thinking, so I've nothing to worry about anymore. That's where no money can buy it. It's just so stress relieving.
Well, thanks to that farming couple for telling me their story as they try to keep their farm. And they've seen some very dark days, as you heard there, but things are looking more hopeful now. And indeed, don't we all need some hope at this time? Now, things changed for them, as you heard, when a PIP, P-I-P, helped them draw up a PIA, P-I-A. So what are PIPs and PIAs? Well, Gary Digney is a personal insolvency practitioner, a PIP, and he's an accountant and he's from a farming background himself. He believes that a personal insolvency arrangement, a PIA, can be a mechanism that would allow a farmer in debt to work through their debts while still keeping the farm. Now, when I spoke to him yesterday, we began by talking about the arrival of investment funds in Ireland.
The whole investment fund, so-called vulture fund situation is very prevalent. I suppose it was born from the ECB putting pressure on Irish banks to deleverage, which meant the mainstream banks really sold these loans and non-performing loans on at a discount, typically to American investment funds. And to give a quick example, the old SEC bank, you know, approximately 1,800 farm loans and loans associated with farmers were sold. And that's just in relation to that bank alone. And of course, there's been further sales from AIB and Ulster Bank. And recently, Danske Bank has pulled out of the country. So there's a significant amount of farming loans that have been sold and are now in the hands of these different entities.
Now, it would seem as well that sentimentality and hard luck stories, they're not allowed to get in the way of these vulture funds to actually get their money in return.
Well, no. The vulture funds, or the so-called vulture funds, they have a short-term strategy in terms of recovering their debt that they've purchased. They tend not to be interested, therefore, in any long-term repayment of the debt. And the issue for farmers, I suppose, is the farmer tends to have a valuable asset in land that the fund, if they are able to sell it, will certainly make a handsome return on what they've paid for the loan in the first place. And that is, in essence, the issue for farmers is it's no longer like owing an old mainstream bank a debt where they would have been reluctant, you know, to repossess a farm or anything. You're dealing with a different entity with a different, I suppose, strategy. And that's where the danger is for farmers, unfortunately.
Aside from bad decision-making, what are other circumstances in which farmers in particular might find themselves in difficulty and maybe in difficulty outside their own hands?
You know, Damien, there's many different reasons why anyone, including farmers, get into difficulties. You know, it spans typically from, you know, ill health, perhaps a poor investment Some overhang from the financial crisis where some farmers did invest in property. You know, I see a number of cases where, you know, dairy herds were extended and new buildings put up. And then, of course, the milk price collapsed a few years ago. And the farming industry, you know, it's a cyclical industry and it's very weather dependent. And quite often there is bumps in the road. And the banks were always willing to work with farmers. It's a different story with a short-term strategy. You know, American vulture fund. You know, they don't allow for this long term thinking or bumps in the road, so to speak.
Gary, will you tell us a little bit more about what is a PIA?
Damien, a PIA was born out of the Personal Insolvency Act. It's called a personal insolvency arrangement. You know, in my view, it should be called a personal recovery arrangement. And it's a formal restructuring tool for individuals who cannot pay their debts as and when they fall due. And effectively, it's a legal agreement between the debtor and their creditors, which importantly includes both secured and unsecured debt. And what I mean by secured debt is things like mortgages on your house or a farm loan attached to land. That's secured debt. And unsecured debt would be things like credit card debt or, you know, in the farming world, it could be monies owed to, you know, the mailman or the creamery or the local vet. So this tool allows both secured and unsecured debts to be restructured at an affordable level whilst retaining the assets.
Farmers would have solicitors, they'd have advisors, accountants, you know, and farm advisors as well. Do they need, though, a personal insolvency practitioner to actually do this work for them? Or can they depend maybe on somebody that they know?
No, the PIAs are licensed by the Insolvency Service in Ireland, and only a personal insolvency practitioner can put forward a PIA. One of the first things a personal insolvency practitioner will do is assess the situation, and they can make an application to court which grants a moratorium. It's called a protective certificate, and this protective certificate is a 70-day protection, a wee bit like examinership in the corporate world. It grants protection, effectively breathing space from the creditors to allow a proposal to be put forward. And in effect, the debt is frozen and the creditor cannot take any steps to recover or secure payment. And that's a vital, vital part of the process. And only a personal insolvency practitioner can do that. And, you know, I would certainly be highlighting today, you know, if you're in debt or if you're an advisor advising someone in debt, it's really important that you are able to access a PIP that can do that, because in the current climate, particularly with so-called vulture funds, it's very important to have that protection in order to save the asset and give the PIP a chance to construct a proposal.
So really, time is of the essence on this?
Absolutely. Time is of the essence. One of the main complaints, I suppose, I hear from farmers on a daily basis is that, you know, I get a phone call and they will say, "Gary, my land's up for sale next week. I didn't realise it was going up for sale." And the reality is, the only way of addressing that situation is to get a protective certificate. And of course, that takes time. So certainly the earlier I see someone, obviously the more options there are available. So time is very much of the essence.
And can all debt situations like this, can they be all resolved with a PIA?
Well, look, the legislation, I have to say, it is magnificent legislation, albeit very complex. It is world-leading legislation. It doesn't exist in any other country in the world that I'm aware of. A personal insolvency arrangement will address a significant number of situations. And I think that the biggest issue is there's a lack of knowledge and a lack of awareness, certainly in the farming community, that this is a potential solution for them.
And indeed, you have been helping many farm families, including one this week, in securing a PIA to save their farm. Is it palpable to you the sense of relief that these farmers in particular feel once a PIA has been put in place?
Absolutely. You know, whether it's a farmer or anyone in debt, these are highly stressful situations. You know, if we take away the reason why they were in debt, being in debt is a very stressful situation. We all know, and my father's a farmer, how important the land is to farmers in particular. And if you're faced with a situation where you are going to lose or potentially going to lose your land, it is highly stressful. And if there's a way of repaying your debt and retaining your land, certainly I think every farmer should be given that opportunity to do so. But we had a case passed this morning, a farmer, two investment funds, one in the home house and one in the land. And the farmer was, you know, days away from losing his land. We were able to apply for a protective certificate, put forward a proposal, which ultimately was granted in court. And the farmer gets 23 years to repay his debts and repay his debts in full. And that farmer now is a different person. You know, you can hear it in his voice. And all he wants to do now is go get back into farming again, pay his debt under the new contract. And I suppose he'll certainly be able to sleep better tonight than he has in a while.
There's always this sense of failure, feeling of shamefulness at getting into this situation. How can we all, or how can farmers and anybody that finds themselves facing this problem, how can they actually get over that issue of what will the neighbours think?
It's difficult for people to admit they're in debt. It's difficult for people, particularly farmers. You know, when I look at my own family, you know, I could just imagine how difficult it would be for them to go and ask for help. But I suppose, to be blunt about it, Damien, is there is help. There is an option. And by burying the head, the situation will not go away. And unfortunately, in the current climate, with these vulture funds in the marketplace, time is not something that farmers have. And it's great to be on a show like this to highlight, to create awareness that there is a solution. It mightn't solve every situation, but it will solve a lot of situations. And, you know, the worst thing that can happen in my mind is that a farmer or anyone loses an asset and then finds out after that that potentially they could have done something about it. And I think it's just another point to maybe raise is 9 out of 10 farmers that I see, it isn't about writing off debt or writing down debt. It's simply getting time to pay the debt. And that's, in my experience, really what farmers want, is just time to pay the debt. So what I would say is always ask for advice. Speak to a personal insolvency practitioner. Review your options and take it from there.
That's advice there from Gary Digney of PKF FPM Accountants, who gave a recent webinar to ICMSA members. And the Insolvency Service of Ireland, it lists all of the personal insolvency practitioners in the country, including Gary. And it's on their register. You'll find all the names there. isi.gov.ie. isi.gov.ie. You're listening to Countrywide here on Radio 1.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Check out tens of thousands of technical articles on our new knowledge hub on farmersjournal.ie.
Now, Catherine Quinn farms with her granddaughter Hannah in County Limerick, and over the course of the past year, and indeed it's almost 12 months since the pandemic began, we've listened to the everyday life that they've enjoyed on their farm together. This week, Catherine and Hannah were surprised by the early arrival of some goslings.
Oh, it's still a bit bitter, isn't it?
It's very cold. Very cold tonight.
So, Granny and I are just heading out because we have a new arrival on the farm. An unexpected one. It's not a baby calf, is it, Granny?
It's not a baby calf. It's a baby gosling. Unusually, we've got a goose hatching at the moment. I don't know whether it's related to climate change or what, but it's very unusual.
So we're just going to creep in here now.
Other door.
Hmm.
Look at that.
Oh, look, its little head is peeping out over her wing. Oh, look. Oh, that's so sweet.
Granny's being very careful, and she's just going in over and having a look, and we're pushing the goose aside because we want to see the nest. So we have the nest here in front of us, Granny. She's got all the eggs covered up under straw, doesn't she?
Yes.
Oh, Mrs. Goose is not happy.
No.
Oh, Gran, look at that. Look.
Oh,
there's a second
one. There's a second one.
It's come. Oh, no. So there's another gosling, and it's just coming out of the egg.
Yes.
Look, it's so funny how they come out all wet and then they get all kind of fluffy afterwards,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
So what's the best thing
so
to do
the
now?
The best thing to do is to just leave her now. And but the night is very cold, so I think I'll get the infrared lamp and set it up just over her, not too close to her so that she gets too hot, but just to have it there and to raise the temperature a little bit.
I'm a bit nervous anyway, because I remember growing up a few times that we had goslings and I went out in the morning and a rat or a mink would have got in, and what were 8 goslings quickly became no goslings.
No goslings at all, yes. It happened. It has happened, yes.
And then we've got the cold to add into that as well.
To add in. So we are...
Because geese aren't always the best mothers. They can be a bit silly sometimes.
That's right. They're not. We come out early in the morning and check again. Good morning, Jim.
He's a good dog. He's a good dog. Going to check on the goose with us? Oh, we can hear her anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So, there's one gosling. I can definitely see one.
One little head peeping out, yes.
So Granny's clambering over the fence now.
Yes.
Is there a second one there? Is it moving?
Yes, 2 goslings. Oh, that's lovely. 2. Excellent. Yes, I better come away now and leave her.
They're a bit vicious, aren't they?
Oh, they are. And she's quiet by goose standards. She's actually a quiet goose.
2 baby goslings there, after all.
2 baby goslings, and there are 4 more eggs. So hopefully we might get a few more.
They're little fluffy sort of grey and yellow replicas of her, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, she's very happy now and she's sitting very well, so that's excellent. Now I need to go and hard boil some eggs for the goslings for the first few days. And then after that, we'll give them a bit of cheek crumb, which is a special feed for young chickens and goslings.
Are you worried that, like, oh, look at the little heads poking out under her wing, aren't they cute?
Yeah.
Are you worried, though, say there are 4 more eggs, are you worried that they're gluggers, which would be, we call them gluggers, but they're essentially unfertilized
eggs? Yes, well, you'll always get 1 or 2 unfertilized eggs. You know, that will all, so out of the 4 eggs, if we got another 2 goslings, I think we'd be very pleased.
Do you know glugger actually comes from the Irish word that means unfertilized egg, but it's an insult. Did you know that? If you call someone a glugeen. Isn't that a weird
a
insult?
Glugeen,
calling someone an unfertilized egg in Irish.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, they're so cute. Look at that. She's made such a lovely nest, lovely cosy nest with straw and feathers all around. It's new life, and it's very hopeful to see that life goes on regardless.
We head in for our breakfast.
Yes, I think a cup of tea and some toast and marmalade wouldn't go amiss.
Come on, Jim. Good job.
Yeah, that was Catherine and Hannah there in Limerick, the latest instalment in their little audio diary that they send us now and again about life on the farm and the latest arrivals there, two little goslings whom we hope are doing very well. Now, one of the big changes to our daily lives over the past 12 months has been the move to working from home, alongside, of course, the shutdown of the high street retail businesses. Offices are empty and city centre shopping districts deserted. So you can imagine the impact that is having on sales of food-to-go products such as pre-packed sandwiches and salads. Now, the Irish-based London-listed Greencore is the UK's largest maker of own-label sandwiches, over 700 million a year, making up the largest chunk of its 1 billion euro business. So how is a large-scale, labour-intensive food company such as Greencore coping at these in these strange times, not to mention with the impact of Brexit to operations as well? Well, Patrick Coveney, CEO of Greencore, he joins me in studio. Good morning and welcome back, Patrick.
Morning, Damien.
Lots to discuss, but first, you know, what has the impact of the pandemic been on that core sandwich and convenience food business?
Yeah, I mean, right now, our food-to-go, our sandwich business, is back about a third year on year, while we're in what we're referring to as lockdown three in the UK. So, I mean, that's significant. It, you know, it means we've got less people working, and it hurts our financial performance. Now, fortunately, we can work our way through that, and we are. But frankly, as I was saying to you beforehand, by far the biggest impact is trying to keep 10 to 12,000 people safe, because while many of our customers have the option of working from home, everyone who works for Greencore pretty much you know, needs to be in food factories, in distribution centres. And so by far the biggest leadership and business challenge for us since last March has been in the context of being absolutely essential to keeping the country fed. How do we keep people safe through this pandemic?
You mentioned there about your staff, and you did actually have a big outbreak in Northampton, was it? Say last July, 300 of your workforce there tested positive, and Mac Hancock ended up getting directly involved. Yeah. It was declared a virus hotspot. Yeah. Just as the CEO of an organisation in a pandemic, trying to mitigate against that, trying to manage the risk as an essential business of continuing, but obviously labour intensive, where they're all working close together. You were probably dreading that call, but can you remember hearing it, and what was your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, I mean, we've been speaking with the Department of Health, and in particular Public Health England, pretty much every day since early March of last year. And actually, just without being too defensive about what happened last August, the support and the validation from Public Health England around the measures that we had in our facility in Northampton was very, very helpful. I mean, what we had was a massive level of community transmission in Northampton, which then was picked up in the testing that we were doing in our facility. But interestingly, what we're doing now, Damien, I think is a really good example of pushing on further. So we, as a business in the UK, we're one of the only food companies that is doing weekly testing of pretty much all our colleagues. So we are now, we're using this technology called lateral flow testing. We have 8,000 Greencore staff that we are testing for COVID every week. Right, it's called the mass testing program, and that first of all is helping us manage COVID. It's very reassuring to all of our colleagues who work for us, and it's now leading, even with the heightened level of concern about the virus and the heightened incidence in the UK, which is still very high. You know, we're running now with an absence level for COVID that's only at about 2.5%. We've got every facility open, and our total absence is about 5%, which is less than half the absence level across the overall supply chain in the UK. So, you know, this is the most important stuff that we can be doing as leaders. We'll make money in the future, don't worry about that. But right now, there's an absolute moral responsibility to keep our people safe while we're getting on with this mission of feeding Britain and indeed also making quite a lot of product in Britain that's being consumed by Irish consumers as well.
Yeah, I'm interested that you're very confident about the future, and I think you said that it, you know, it might be 2022 before you start making money, as you say, again. But one of the long-term legacies of COVID possibly will be that more and more of us will be working from home. There'll be less of us commuting. And that's where you pick up a lot of business, people on the run, running into a sandwich shop, grabbing it and going. So are you thinking about the future and maybe thinking outside the box about how you recoup that business?
Absolutely. I mean, now, I think dependence on our business for office workers is a little overstated. So about 30% of our sandwich sales go to office workers. So the other 70% is, you know, mobile tradespeople, students, retired people, people on holiday, people working from, you know, where they're required to move around a lot. So the 30% of people who, you know, office workers in city centres is important, but we still have a very big business in other parts of the market. I think we are all going to see some changes to how people work. My own my personal view is that some of that is a little overstated. You know, like if you engage with people who are currently working from home, lots of them don't like it. About two-thirds, in fact, are strongly advocating for and looking forward to being able to get back into an environment where they can engage with colleagues and, frankly, in many cases, get out of the home, where it works for some people at some stages in life. But, you know, I can tell you, having lots and lots of young people who work for us, that, you know, working in cramped spaces with young kids who can't go to school, it's very, very stressful.
Speaking of that, are you hearing that from people about, you know, the tough January in particular, that it's been, you know, in terms of mental health and stress?
Yeah, I think January's been brutal, to be honest with you. I mean, we've had the COVID pressures, we've had the added COVID pressures of the new strain and how virulent it is. You and I were talking just before I came on, but, you know, all of us, you know examples of COVID very, very close to home. And we know of bereavements close to home, whether it be work colleagues or people in our extended community.
I think the
top of that, though, sorry, we've got the kind of traditional January blues, like it's dark, it's raining all the time. So it feels like the month that's gone on forever, to be honest with you. And that is feeding through to be a bit more serious. It's to mental health pressures that are very significant across all parts of society. And we see that in the people who work for us.
You know? Okay. I presume you would have travelled quite a lot prior to all of this, your headquarters in Dublin, but obviously a lot of plants in the UK and so on. That's all changed. You've been more grounded probably and doing more virtual meetings and all that. Yeah. Is that something that's going to change as well? Or do you think we'll all be itching to get back to face-to-face meetings and travelling around again?
I think it's huge change for me, right? I mean, I would have had, you know, I would have been out of Ireland 3.5 days a week for a decade before COVID, right? And that's the nature of the job. That's how I do it. I like to be out with my teams, our teams, with our customers, suppliers, shareholders and all that. You know, since last March, I've left the country for work once. I did 2 weeks in October in the UK. And the rest of it has all been virtual. So I think two things will happen in relation to travel going forward. One is I think there will be a natural almost overcompensation when we can travel to get out, to spend time with, you know, in our business, with our teams, with our customers. But I think there are some things that we've learned, right, that it is possible to do more. You know, virtually, it is possible to do more through what have become the kind of dreaded Zooms and Teams calls, right? And I think there are elements of travel that were done before that I think we've learned are a little unnecessary. But speaking personally, I can't wait to get moving again, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to segue from the pandemic neatly to Brexit. The EU and the UK, as we know, in the last 24 hours, the last week, they've had the first real post-deal scrap regarding the rollout of vaccines and threats of triggering Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Is this a glimpse of relations to come?
Yeah, there's going to be some tensions, all right. I mean, just narrowly on that, the EU got it wrong, and I'm glad they changed their mind, because the moment you start invoking these clauses in the Northern Ireland Protocol, you open it up for all sorts of uncertainties. And so it was a mistake and it's been fixed, which is good. But I think the...
And the reason I ask you that is because you're running a business in the UK where you're going to be importing an awful lot of ingredients. You're going to be doing an awful lot of east-west, west-east trade with Ireland, for example. So you would be keeping an eye on relations there and hoping that the will be smooth.
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects to it, Damien, for us, right? So the first is, you know, we sell about £1.5 billion sterling of product every year pre-COVID, right? And so we buy £750 million sterling worth of raw material and packaging. Nearly 100 million of that comes from Ireland, actually. And the fortunately, with the tariff-free trading arrangements and the supply chain systems as they are, we're not having any problem in sourcing raw materials and packaging at the moment, nor are we seeing material levels of inflation. So that's good, right? The challenge is the portion of our business, it's about 2% of Greencore, that we would sell into Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland. And, you know, I think what we're finding is those supply chains are much more complicated, and particularly for fresh food, which might only have 5, 6, 8 days life on product. What we're finding right now is that the Northern Ireland Protocol and the associated trading arrangements is taking 2 to 3 days of that life out of the product. And that's a problem. Because, you know, clearly, you know, if you're a consumer picking up a ready meal or a punnet of raspberries, right, and you're
3 days,
and suddenly you've lost 3 days life, and you thought you were going to be able to have 6 days to eat, you only have three.
But have these nightmare scenarios at Calais and Dover, have they come true yet, or is it still early?
The Calais Dover much hyped problems haven't really come to pass. The big issue, and I think it is a real issue for Ireland, and it's an issue for British Irish trade, and it's in Britain. It's very high profile in relation to Northern Ireland, because all of our customers are under very significant pressure to keep shelves stocked and Northern Ireland citizens, you know, served with food. In Ireland, we have some problems too, right? You go to some of the retailers here, and they're struggling to get to keep up availability of fresh ingredients. So it's a problem. It's a consequence of Brexit. I think we'll get a bit better, but you're going to see sustained pressure on both governments and on the EU to see whether or not there are tweaks that you could put in place over time that make it a bit easier. The kind of stuff that happened last night isn't helpful, to be honest with you, and that kind of dialing up of tension between... but listen, like, vaccinations is a big issue, right?
Yeah.
It's the solution to COVID. There's rightly a ton of emotion about it. And, you know, I say this... here, you know, I think the EU and I think Ireland, for the most part, has managed the healthcare side of this quite well. I mean, on a per capita basis, Damien, where, you know, Britain has had more than three times as many deaths from COVID as Ireland. But they are going to vaccinate their population 6 months before we will.
Yeah,
right? I mean, and that's bad.
When you talk there about Calais Dover not happening, when you look at how the EU had to pull their horns in yesterday, when you look at the vaccinations, all that. The Brexiteers are really going to be able to say to us, we told you so, best thing we ever did.
That is probably an unfortunate consequence of this, yeah. I mean, they probably are two different things, but the truth is, for whatever combination of skill, luck, planning, call it what you will, Britain is going to succeed in vaccinating its population probably 6 months before we will, right? And that is, that will give a... sucker to the Brexiteers in the UK. They'll attribute it to Brexit. I don't think it is because of Brexit, but they'll say it's a benefit of Brexit.
Right. Finally, about a minute to go. You're also, I know, involved in Irish sailing, and you're a liaison there with the Olympic Federation of Ireland. Will the Olympics go ahead?
Probably. We're certainly planning for it going ahead. If it does, it'll be a different kind of Olympics. I mean, I think, there's so many different competing factors here, Damien. But one of the things I think we're all learning is that in this very challenging time to sport is a great refuge for society, right? It's and the Olympic movement is going to want to find a way of putting the Olympics on. They are currently planning on doing it. It'll obviously have less crowds. There's going to be a big debate around whether the athletes get vaccinated and when. But for the moment, we're certainly planning on it going ahead.
Okay. And my final question related to sport as well. You're very much involved with Munster Rugby. The Six Nations starting next week. There will be a debate about whether sport should be continuing or not in the current circumstances. On balance, is it right that we should allow elite sport continue?
It's absolutely right. I mean, what we've got to balance here is the risk to the athletes and
sports people,
and sports people, the risk of athletes being a super spreaders for the virus. But also, we've got to look after the mental health of the wider population. I mean, frankly.
The GAA was a great savior
for a lot of
people.
Whether it be the GAA or Premiership Soccer or Six Nations Rugby, we need something to be doing in this pandemic, you know?
Absolutely. Well, especially if your team is winning as well, it always softens it as well. Patrick, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Patrick Coveney there, CEO of Greencore, right at the heart of things in the UK in relation to the pandemic. That's all we have time for this week. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. The programme was produced by Eileen Herron. Don't forget, Ear to the Ground, RT1 Television on Thursday at 7. And coming up after the news here in Radio 1 is Playback.